Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. For the latest news of this world at war, we present members of our staff of reporters from overseas for first-hand news. First, we take you to Australia.
This is Matthew Nebraska, somewhere in Australia. The weak lull in the air war to the north was broken yesterday with raids on the Jap New Guinea bases at Ley and Samoa that resulted in the greatest Allied aerial victory so far scored in this theater of the war. 13 of a flock of Jap Aero fighters were destroyed or crippled when they attempted to intercept our bombers. For this aerial destruction and the damage caused by our bombs to the Jap bases, our Air Force paid with the loss of only two of our raiding machines. Yesterday's bag of 13 Jap fighters is the largest number ever shot down or damaged in a single action in the war area to the north of Australia. According to pilot's combat report, even the greater speed, climbing power, and maneuverability of the new Jap Navy Zero fighters are not enough to outclass our fast medium bombers used in yesterday's raid. If there is one thing that any careful study of combat reports of American warplanes in this area reveals, it is the immense superiority of our bomber development over our fighter development in the past. There have been innumerable instances of our fighters closing in on Jap fighters for the kill, and then seeing the Jap zoom straight up out of danger before our pilots had the chance to put in the decisive burst of fire. In Burma, and to some extent in this area, the skill of the most expert of our pilots has nullified the defects of our fighter plane. But too often, these same defects have contributed greatly to the defeat of some of the comparatively inexperienced among our pilots. This is something our fighter producers at home should think about. Again, of our medium bombers, I have only the one unchanging complaint to pass on to you. That is this, that there aren't enough of them. The announcement today of a Jap sub's surface attack on an Allied ship somewhere off the Australian southeast coast is a reminder that perhaps the most important of the Jap threats to Australia at the moment remain submarine attacks on our shipping. While nuisance raids, such as the shelling of Sydney and Newcastle a couple of days ago, are relatively unimportant, a large-scale Jap sub-offensive against Allied shipping in these waters can't be left off very easily. Shipping is the most vital of the Allied problems in every area of this war. A ship sunk off the Australian coast is as much a loss as one sunk off the Atlantic coast of the United States. With some 22,000 miles of coastline to defend, large numbers of patrol planes are required here for the single purpose of protecting our shipping. To be forced to divert our fast bombers to this work would be a terrible waste of offensive power. Planes and more planes remain the most vital of our needs here. This is Martin Agronsky returning you now to San Francisco.
Next, we hear from our reporter on duty in Russia. Go ahead, Moscow.
Magidov speaking from Moscow. The battle for Sebastopol has reached a new pitch. Ignoring losses, the Germans are increasing the scope, ferocity, and frequency of their attacks. Oblivious to danger, the defenders are holding strong. The net result of the 6 days of the storming of Sebastopol is practically nil for the Germans. They are still where they started from, everywhere except at one place. There, 3 days of incessant artillery and trench mortar fire and ceaseless raids by the Luftwaffe allow German infantry to penetrate to the outer edge of two heights. The stubbornness of resistance was so great that that enemy troops managed to make this slight advance only under cover of darkness. But the heights are by no means in enemy hands as yet. The Germans are making an all-out effort to gain complete mastery of the air at Sebastopol. The skies are practically always dotted with planes engaged in savage dogfights. Occasionally, German planes do break through the barrage of anti-aircraft fire or escape the wrath of Soviet fighters and bomb the city. They also bomb the positions held by the Red Army and the Marines. But these men mean to hold or die. They are holding. There is no large-scale fighting on other fronts, but the stage is perfectly set for decisive battles. Reserves of manpower and machines have been amassed by both sides at every vital sector. The long-awaited summer weather has already set in practically all parts of the country, and Russia's vast spaces allow plenty of room for maneuver. The big push will come soon, very soon. Where, when, who will start it? Only time will tell. Goodbye from Moscow.
Now to a third United Nations capital, this time to the capital of Great Britain.
This is London. John McVane speaking. Military quarters in London today believe the Germans are making their big effort of the moment against Bir Hakeim. The fighting French in Libya are well dug in and camouflaged. They're protected by minefields, and some of the guns are sighted to fire at approaching tanks over open sites. The supply line into Bir Hakeim isn't continuous, but it's emphasized here that this isn't necessary as long as the enemy aren't occupying the supply route all the time. It's said here that supply convoys are getting through. Today's official report says British armored and motorized forces yesterday helped the French drive off a large-scale attack. Rommel threw more tanks, dive bombers, infantry, and artillery against Bir Hakeim, but the drive, like all the others, failed. British mobile columns are still slashing away at the enemy supply line that stretches out westward, and in the Cauldron area there have been battles between British and Axis armored units. It was stated in London today that the British Navy is doing two jobs in the Libyan battle, attacking Rommel's supply ships and guarding the flow of Allied equipment that's being thrown into the battle through Tobruk. The British had a lot of news in their papers this morning, most of it good news. If you were here to read the London press, you'd have seen front-page headlines telling of the Anglo-American plan to pool war resources and food. This is taken here as one of the final links in the chain for closer cooperation of the two nations' war effort. The pooling, the British hope, will have a favorable effect on the vital shipping situation. The British are still reading and hearing today about the two submarine heroes who got the Victoria Cross. They risked their lives to get rid of two unexploded bombs that had hit their submarine. Crawling through a two-foot-high black passage, they dragged out one bomb that made a twanging noise every time they moved. They knew that any second the submarine might have to submerge and they'd both be drowned. There's an item of humor, too, in a naive statement by Lord Wilton, the food minister, about the tea ration that's been given to children under five. After July 27th, they won't get any more tea. Lord Wilton said, "I'm told tea is not good for children under five. If I'd known that earlier, perhaps we should not have given them any." On the home front, the papers are speculating about the coming debate in Parliament on the government's fuel plan. Backbench conservatives will probably try to get the government to shelve the rationing scheme indefinitely. Labourites will ask that rationing be put into effect at once. The government has taken a middle course of postponing rationing until it becomes absolutely necessary, a compromise solution that may mean there'll be less coal to go around when rationing finally is introduced, as seems inevitable. But the government will probably put its scheme into effect without much trouble. Few Britishers believe there's any imminent danger of a German invasion, but the strength of the Home Guard is to be greatly increased by conscription and volunteers. New instructions are being given to civilians as to how to act if Britain is invaded. Stout-hearted citizens will be asked to help overcome small bands of the enemy, and civilians generally will take a more active part in the battle. It's worthwhile noting in this connection that if Britain's regular troops were used to invade the continent, the defense of England against possible counterattacks would be more or less up to the Home Guard. In the Libyan fighting, the gallantry of de Gaulle's fighting French, defending Bir Hakeim under the tricolor flag of France that bears the cross of Lorraine, has captured the imagination of the British press and public. The Daily Express calls Bir Hakeim the Libyan Verdun and Koenig's Inferno. The Daily Mail says, "Bir Hakeim has shown that the spirit of Verdun lives on. This is the France we used to know, gallant and gay. It's the spirit which made her great and will again raise her from the dust and ashes of humiliation. The London News Chronicle quotes General de Gaulle as saying in June 1940, France has lost a battle, but has not lost the war. The trade union organ, the Daily Herald, declares Bir Hakeim is a reminder to the world that the spirit of Valmy and Verdun still live, that France will still play her worthy part in the defeat of Hitler. All France, the Herald adds, will salute General Koenig and his men. We too, fighting men to fighting men, allies to allies, salute them and hail as fine a feat of arms as any in a rich history. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Finally, here's the news at home, reported by Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. The president takes command of the rubber and gas situation. Announcing a nationwide scrap rubber hunt will be the best way to find out just how much old rubber there is. Count it and don't talk about it. A committee of the House of Representatives also starts an investigation into the charge that the four main rubber companies have finagled the situation so they can control the rubber from now on, particularly after the war. This committee, headed by Representative Summers of Brooklyn, New York, has now taken for its counsel an independent rubber dealer named Elliot Simpson, who has been sending out statements for weeks past claiming that the big rubber boys were no less than rubber barons and were concealing the facts. Simpson has been putting out statement after statement claiming there's 10 million tons of scrap rubber, enough, he says, to take care of all current civilian needs. If he is true or not, the president at least has called a turn in establishing a nationwide rubber pickup, which is not yet organized, so don't send your old boots to the White House just yet. However, Simpson has sold the House committee on the idea that the four big rubber barons have planted their own officials in the wartime setup here in Washington. These charges were serious enough for Chairman Summers of this special subcommittee to initiate an investigation. But the president's action may put a damper on this committee work for the time being. The recruiting of the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps officer candidates from the Aircraft Warning Service volunteers will begin tomorrow. The program is entirely separate from the general recruiting for officer candidates, which closed June 4. Aircraft Warning Service volunteers were carefully selected and trained by the Army Signal Corps and have been in operation for some time. The G-men, who are working too hard these days to tell what's going on in their outfit, have admitted that among their wartime achievements is the silencing of 13 radio stations that have been working in the interests of the Axis. Not these big listed stations like you and I are familiar with, but hidden affairs capable of sending either to Tokyo or Berlin. They've been discovered with the help of the Federal Communications Commission Monitoring Service. They have been silenced by the G-men. Today, the spy work which is going on must be reported by mail, if at all. It can't be done by radio anymore. It's now almost impossible for an enemy radio station in this country to get a message to a submarine lurking near any of our shores. It is impossible for the Axis to direct any sabotage work by radio from there to here. This, of course, leaves only the slow mail from here to some South American country, for instance, whence it can be remailed to a European country and there sent to the Axis headquarters. It's a very far from satisfactory mode of communication in these days when instantaneous report are required. And here's a smart move. The President and Churchill announced simultaneously two great big organizations to coordinate all industrial production and all the food supplies on our side. One immediate result of this huge organization may be to save 25% in ocean shipping space in the ships that go from here to there and around the world, and that really is tremendous, and that's all from Washington at this time.
And there you have the up-to-the-minute news, given to you direct from Australia by Martin Negronsky, from Moscow by Robert Magadov, from England by John McVane, and from our own nation's capital by Earl Godwin. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.